God bless you, Steve. That's wonderful. We'll try to have a second sermon this morning, too. We already had one. That's as powerful a one as you could have. May God bless us as we draw nearer to the end of this series on marriage and the home. Probably one more lesson on this series will bring it to a close. I came across something I want to read that I didn't know where to put it in, but I want to put it in for your thoughts. These are some things that parents most often repeat. Where's your other shoe? I told you it would break. Give it back to the little boy. This is the last time. Because, just simply because. Take that out of your mouth. No, go to sleep. We'll see. Don't ask me again. Right this minute. If you run over my heel one more time with that shopping cart, these are things that are very definitely connected with our homes. These are, some of the things are restrictive. Some of them are perhaps things that you do not prefer, but they are things that happen in and around and about our homes. And they are things that we must cope with and endure many times. Just as the poem by Edgar A. Guest also refers to things that are not always pleasant, but they are a permanent part of the home. The first verse of his poem says, "You've got to weep to make it home. You've got to sit and sigh and watch beside a loved one's bed and know that death is nigh. And in the stillness of the night to see death's angel come and close the eyes of her that smiled and leave her sweet voice dumb. For these are scenes that grip the heart, and when your tears are dried, you find that home is dearer than it was and sanctified. And tugging at you always are the pleasant memories of her that was and is no more. You can't escape from these." So far in our studies on the home, we've noticed things that make a marriage. And we've limited ourselves almost exclusively to that. However, one of the things that we noticed in one of the lessons was entitled "Things That Break a Marriage." We learned that it was not a lack of money or a lack of physical love, but that it was actually character flaws that were contained in the personalities of those who make up the marriage, that these were the major threat to the home or to the marriage. And yet, even as we dealt with those negative things of what breaks the marriage, all of these things together actually focused on internal factors, internal personalities, responsibilities, the role of the male, the role of the woman, the female. And these are the things that dealt with the internal problems or the internal factors that make or break a marriage. And you can sum those up in one verse from the Sermon on the Mount, though we did not use any of the Sermon on the Mount specifically. We majored more in Ephesians 5, 1 Corinthians 11, 1 Corinthians 7, and some other passages of Scripture related to this theme. But the one statement made by Jesus, "Whoever hears these words of mine and does them shall be like a man that built his house upon the rock. The rains descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it stood, because it was founded upon the rock." And in all that we've said, we've attempted to direct our minds to the teachings of Jesus Christ. This morning, I want to turn our attention not to another internal subject, but to things that relate to externals. The emphasis, I think, properly should have been on the internals. But I felt like I would be doing you an injustice if I did not point out some of the externals, some external factors, which, if they are ignored in your life and mine as we order our marriages and order our families, the absence of these warnings or the absence of heeding them will be tantamount to disaster in your marriage and in your home. There are just three of these that we want to notice this morning. One is religious, the second is entitled social, and the third is entitled physical. They're listed perhaps in the order of importance. At least I think the first one would have to come at the heading of any list of things to be aware of as you choose a mate and build your home. And that is the religious aspect of your marriage and your home. Whenever you choose a mate who shares your religious convictions. One of the most serious errors made by young people is made whenever they choose a mate who does not share their religious convictions. The principle now is universal. I believe that a Muslim ought to marry a Muslim. I believe that a Buddhist ought to marry a Buddhist. I believe a Shintoist ought to marry a Shintoist and a Taoist a Taoist. That's the general principle. For how can two walk together unless they be agreed? And in a matter so vital as religion, how can two possibly be one unless they're agreed in that which is such a part, a major part of their life? The principle holds true universally. But I'm not approaching it this morning from the standpoint of the Buddhist or the Taoist or the Shintoist. I'm approaching it from the standpoint of the Judo-Christian background, the Judeo-Christian background that we share today in our faith. In the Old Testament, in Deuteronomy the 7th chapter, verse 3 and 4 says, "You shall not make marriages with them," that is, with the nations round about you, "giving your daughters to their sons and taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly." There is a prohibition here, an explanation, and a warning. The prohibition is you shall not give your daughters to their sons nor take your daughters for your sons. Secondly, there's the reason. "For they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods." And then there's the warning. "Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you and he would destroy you quickly." So he simply lays it out in 1, 2, 3 order. Don't do it for this reason, and here's the warning. Now, in the New Testament, in the book of 2 Corinthians, chapter 6 and verse 14, there's a similar prohibition given to us as Christians. In that very memorable passage, it just simply says in verse 14 of 2 Corinthians 6, and I want you to turn there if you have your Bibles, 2 Corinthians 6, 14. I want you to see what it says with your eyes and then listen as I read it. And listen carefully. "Do not be mismated with unbelievers. For what partnership have righteousness and iniquity? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever?" And then here again, he lays it out, the prohibition, and then the reason. He doesn't ask us here in such an important place to just follow in blind faith. He asks us to accept this prohibition, but then he gives us a very real reason. He says, "Do not be mismated with unbelievers." Obviously, that would include marriage. If you would think that this does not include marriage, then may I ask you, what would it include? If it would not include marriage, the bond of which there is never any closer bond than it, there is no greater unity or no greater bond and no more closely related relationship than this that relates you to another person in marriage. If this verse does not apply to marriage, then pray tell me, what does it apply to? No, this applies to marriage. Do not be mismated with unbelievers. And then here's the reason. For what partnership have righteousness and iniquity? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? Or what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? There's no way of getting around it. That applies to marriage, or else it doesn't mean anything. But then there's a third passage, and that's found in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, and verse 39. Here it also deals specifically. It deals with a person who is a widow. A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives. If the husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes. Isn't that wonderful that the widow is given that freedom? That the woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she's free to marry whomever she wishes. Except that's not all of the verse. The verse continues and qualifies this. It said, only in the Lord. Now you may say, well, what does that mean? It just means what it says. It means that a widow may marry anybody that she wants, provided that that man is in the Lord. Now you say, well, are you sure it means that? Yes. Well, how are you sure? Well, from the common, most easily determined meaning of the verse. It says whom she may marry, and then it puts one qualification on it. She's free to marry whomever she wills, only in the Lord. And if that doesn't mean that it restricts the widow to marrying a Christian, then I don't know the meaning of language. But you ask why? Why would this restriction be placed upon a widow? For this simple reason. I don't know of any person that is as vulnerable as a widow. Only those people, for example, teenagers in love and widows insecure, I think are vulnerable. Teenagers in love are vulnerable. They can't see. They can't understand many times why they should be prohibited from marrying someone that they think they love. A widow who is insecure, she also is vulnerable. In fact, I think perhaps she's more vulnerable, perhaps at times, depending upon her personality, but she can be more vulnerable than a teenager in love. For she's had her security removed. She's had her props taken away from her. She's had her companion removed. And I've seen women on the rebound marry the first no-count bum that came along. Her family knew that it was a mistake. Her friends knew that it was a mistake. But the woman could not see it, and it turned out to be a disaster. There are many of you who will have people in your memory that you'll know and you'll identify, they did that very thing. That's why he protects the widow here. A widow may marry whomever she will, but only if he is in the Lord, only in the Lord. But this prohibition does not just bind those of us who are Christians from marrying those who are heathen. Obviously it does. It restricts those who are believers in Jesus Christ from marrying a Buddhist or a Shintoist or a Taoist or something of that nature. It involves and restricts us from marrying anyone whose philosophy is counter to the philosophy of Jesus Christ. But something more than that is involved. And I think the statistics that have been compiled during our lifetimes say that there is something more involved. There's the practicality of it, of just simply being joined to someone who's going in at least, if not a diametrically opposed direction, at least in a divergent direction from that which in which you're going. For example, when I was a young man, as a teenager, looking for my mate, there was a study conducted among using 4,108 marriages. And this study showed that mixed marriages were 5 times as likely to divorce as non-mixed marriages, the percentage being 20.6% as opposed to 4.4%. And that's found in the book Building a Successful Marriage by Landis. It's an old work, some 25 years old or more. It represents that particular period of time. But today, look at today's statistics. The average or the batting average of marriages today and divorces in America is about 1 out of every 3 are breaking up. 1 out of every 3, perhaps 30% of our marriages today are ending in divorce. If you'll compare the general batting average in the world today with the batting average of people who have been taught to marry those who are of the same faith, and that means this community here, you'll see a great difference in statistics. Now, the old statistic that we had some 10 years ago, that Harding alumni who married among themselves, that the percentage of divorce was about 1%, maybe not even 1%, but fluctuating around 1%. It's been revised within the last few weeks, and the revision shows us that there has been a doubling, perhaps, of the incidence of divorce among Harding alumni. But even so, if it rises on up to 2.5%, if it means that out of every 100 marriages of Harding alumni, Christian people who've married among themselves, 2 out of every 100, or 2.5 out of every 100, fail, that's a far cry different from the 30% that fail in the world. Now, I know that those two sets of figures are not definitely perfectly comparable. I realize that. But you'll have to take into consideration that the safeguard of marrying someone who is a Christian has to be considered a valuable attribute to you as you look for your mate. Today, we're living in a time when divorce is running rampant. If you do not share the same convictions with a person, don't marry him. Now, you ask why. Why is it so dangerous? Well, let me say this. It's only dangerous if you don't have any convictions. If your religion is just one of convenience, where you're happy to go one place or the other, it does not matter, and it's not based upon conviction, then I would suggest go on and marry whom you please. It really won't make any difference, because you don't really have anything going for your marriage anyway, unless you're basing it upon conviction. Because when the first real test comes, you're going to fly the coop, and you're going to leave her standing there holding the bag. Or she'll fly the coop, and she'll leave you standing there holding the bag, unless your marriage is based upon convictions. But if you're a Christian because of conviction, and not just a church member, if you're a Christian because of conviction, here's the reason why you must marry a Christian who is also under conviction. Because you'll never be able to be one with one who is not one with you at the center of your being. And religion that is based upon conviction becomes that which is the center of your being. And a person in whose life Jesus is the center of his being must marry another person in his life who in his life has Jesus at the center of his being. It is inconceivable to me that a person who has Jesus Christ as the Lord of his life would find himself or herself being willing to marry someone else whom Jesus is not Lord over. I cannot understand how that would ever make any sense. It only would bring disaster. So be careful. This very first, number one, warning is a religious warning. If you're looking for a successful marriage, do not marry someone who is different from you in your faith. May I say this by just the side? Don't think that just marrying a member of the church is going to guarantee success. It won't. You'd better find somebody that loves God more than he loves you, or else you're in store for a real rocky road. There are many members of the church who are not converted to Christ. There are many members of the church who do not have Jesus Christ at the center of their being. And if you do, you'd better look for someone else that has him at the center of their being. The second thing that I would like to warn about is the social aspect of your marriage, the social aspect of your home. If you're planning a home and you do not plan for the home to be the center of the activity of the family, you're planning for failure. Furthermore, whenever your home, if it already exists, whenever it begins to let other things be the center of its activities, then you're inviting dissolution. You're inviting disintegration. To integrate means to bring together in one. To disintegrate means to cause or allow to go apart from oneness. And whenever your home ceases to be the center of activity for the family, then you're inviting disintegration. In fact, disintegration is already underway. Once everything that we did took place either in the home or was around the home, but it had the home as its focal point. The play that the students put on last night and Friday night in the academy, entitled Our Town. You should have seen it if you didn't. It's a beautiful story of a New England town during the turn of the century. That town was made up of homes where the activities of the family centered around that home. And it was a very wholesome situation. We don't have that today. Edgar Guest also had this in mind when he spoke of the home in the second verse of his poem. You've got to sing and dance for years. You've got to romp and play and learn to love the things you have by using them each day. Even the roses round the porch must blossom year by year before they come a part of you, suggesting someone dear who used to love them long ago and trained them just to run the way they do so they'd get the early morning sun. You've got to love each brick and stone from cellar up to dome. It takes a heap of living in a house to make it home. The reason why I'm smiling was because that due to an oversight, I cut down everything my wife had planted over the last 6 months, and things are a bit tight around there now. And I wondered whether I ought to read this thing about the roses around the porch, but I felt I better go ahead and read it. But you've got to have activities centered around the home. She's forgiven me, but I'm still trying to wrestle with it. I'm still trying to find those rosebuds that were cut off. But anyway, we've got to make our homes the center of our activities. Otherwise, our homes are going to be in trouble. Listen, if you will, contrast this concept with this statement by the young girl who was asked about a home. She says, replied, "A home? Why do I need a home? I was born in a hospital, educated in a college, courted in an automobile, and married in a church. I get my food at restaurants and at delicatessens. I spend my mornings at golf, my afternoons at bridge, and my evenings dancing or at the movies. And when I die, I'll be buried from the undertakers. All I need is a garage." And truthfully, all that this generation seems to need would be a two-car garage. Because the other part of this social problem is that we are living in a state of mobility and rootlessness. Mobility plus rootlessness equals disintegration of the home. Mobility plus rootlessness equals a totally transient society. I mean by rootlessness this simple fact, that in America, the average family moves from one location to another every 2 years. That means that we have an average tenure in our homes for 2 years at a time only. That means that we have no time to develop roots. That means that that which provided the root structure of our society has now been eroded away, and we don't have any root system in our society anymore. And then I mean by mobility, even during the two-year stay, our jobs many times send our husbands on such long jaunts and send them out for extended periods of time away from the family, away from the wife, to where the relationship there is strained. The wife grows up, the husband grows up, separate and apart many times from each other and from the children. And as a result of our rootlessness and our mobility, we're inviting a state of total transiency or a total transient society. The two-car curse is another part of this social scourge. We're being cursed with two cars. The wife can go one direction, the husband can go another direction, and many times in a family, every child has his own car, so everybody can split and go his own direction, and all that the home is used for is a place to hang your hat while you're changing your clothes to go out somewhere else. And as a result, we're not finding the glue, the binding togetherness that the home has always provided and that God intended for it to provide. Some people are even going on separate vacations, where she takes her car and goes on in one direction, he takes his car and goes in another. And I suspect they flip to see who's going to have to take the children with them, and the one that loses takes the children. But that's the social situation that we're living in today. Then there's a third, and that is the physical. Religious, number one. Social, number two. The physical is the third or number three, warning that I'd like to leave with you this morning, and that is when the wife goes outside the home to work. And I know this isn't a very popular subject in the world today, but I'm convinced that the wives going outside the home to work is one of the most serious threats to the stability and the permanence of the home. It's interesting that one out of every three of all wives work outside the home. Now, that's from an article from the U.S. News and World Report, April 16, 1973, page 71. One out of three of all wives work out. It's interesting that one out of every three homes don't work out. And that's a play on words. The wives, one out of three of all wives, work outside the home. One out of three marriages don't work out, period. They disintegrate and come apart. Let me read you what Sweden has done. Sweden has declared war on the home. In 1968, the Swedish government issued a report called The Status of Women in Sweden. Stockholm's Socialist Daily headlined its story, Women, Don't Let a Man Support You. Now, does that sound familiar to you? This is the cry of the women's liberation movement. Don't let a man support you. Be on your own. Be independent. This is where it came from. This is the background out of which it comes. Women, don't let a man support you. And then this paper made this very affirmative and favorable comment on the government's action. The government is making an assault on marriage. The place of woman is in the labor market, not the home. That's the quotation that was taken from the government publication in Sweden, that the woman's place is in the labor market, not in the home. The following year, the Swedish Minister of Justice established a committee to study the abolition of marriage in the old sense. The new laws accomplishing this abolition may be enacted to take effect on July 1, 1973, according to this paper. They may mean, or it will mean, the end of both religious and civil marriage ceremonies. A simple notification will replace both marriage and, after a 3 or 6 month period of reflection, divorce. Marriage will officially mean little more for a couple than a common address. There are no special duties or rights. The Swedish tax reforms of 1970 had already abolished all the tax advantages of marriage. In fact, not only do children born out of wedlock now receive larger state subsidies than those born to a married couple, but unmarried parents get a better tax break and the children get a better deal at the state-run day nurseries. Now, if that sounds like a preview of what's coming to America, I think that's right. We're about 10 years behind Sweden, and that may give or take a year or two, but we're headed in that same direction. You say, why do you place this under the heading of physical? And for three reasons, I thought, and I asked myself the question this morning, why was it that I placed it under physical? And it's for this simple reason. Number one, the wife works outside the home to provide physical, not spiritual goods. She's working outside the home to provide physical things, not spiritual things. Second, she works outside the home, and in order to compete in today's labor market or any day's labor market in the world, she must be physically capable or mentally capable, not spiritually capable. They couldn't care less how spiritually adept you are or how spiritually well off you are. They want you physically and mentally capable. Thirdly, when she comes home, she is physically tired, not spiritually exercised. So I say it's physical, yes. She goes outside to earn physical goods. They want her physically capable, and she comes home physically tired. I think it would have to be placed under a physical warning, that here is a very real warning that needs to be issued about your marriages. Is the wife outside working? Now, I know that in this community, we have many women who work. Some are widows who have to work. That's another issue. Others are wives of students who work to put their husbands through school. Others are wives of teachers who could be making twice the amount that they're making here somewhere else, but they're working here because they love Christian education and they love your children and they love Christians in general. And the wives are working in order to supplement that income. And you may say, well, it really doesn't matter then, but the question still remains, does it? Does it really and truly not matter? Maybe your home will be an exception. Maybe it won't. But I urge you to think about it as being one of the danger points. How different is the divine arrangement from the way the world looks at the marriage? The world would send the wives and mothers out into the community and out into the labor force. Marriage, as far as God is concerned, would keep them back in the home, doing the most important job in the world. In 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 10, the writer there gives the qualifications of a woman being supported as a widow, and he lists these very important attributes of her as a mother and wife. She must be the wife of one husband. She must be well attested for her good deeds as one who has brought up children, shown hospitality, washed the saints' feet, relieved the afflicted, and devoted herself to doing good in every way. And then in Titus chapter 2, 4, and 5, the older women were told to teach the younger women what is good. And here's what he says is what is good. Train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be sensible, chaste, domestic, kind and submissive to their husbands, that the word of God may not be discredited. The word domestic here is translated in older translations, keepers of the home or keepers at home. This is God's concept of the home. It's where we have the same religious conviction, where all of us, where husband and wife have their lives joined together in the oneness that exists when Jesus Christ is Lord, both of the husband and of the wife, where the home is the center of the social activities, the activities of the family that centers around the home. And then thirdly, where the husband does the earning, the wife is at home to raise the children and keep the home fires burning and provide that stability that cannot be provided without the parent being in the home. There's a poem by Grace Noel Crowell that I want to close with. She says, so long as there are homes to which men turn at close of day, so long as there are homes where children are and women stay, if faith and love and loyalty are found across these sills, a stricken nation can recover from grievous ills. So long as there are homes where fires burn and there's bread, so long as there are homes where lamps are lit and prayers are said, though a people falter in darkness and nations grope, with God himself back of these little homes, we still have hope. The question that I pose today is, do we have enough homes in America who possess those qualities that would give us hope about our nation? I'm beginning to wonder if we do. If we as Christians don't provide that salt and provide that kind of family in the community, if we don't provide that light, there's not anybody else to provide it, because the world is making an assault on marriage in the home today. To ignore these three very vulnerable points in your marriage, the religious aspect, the social aspect, and the physical, to ignore these warnings is the same thing as inviting disaster, and would qualify under what Jesus said when he said, whoever hears these words of mine and does not do them, he'll be like a foolish man that built his house on the sand. The rains descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell. And great was the fall of it. What about your homes today? Let's give them priority. Let's take whatever steps are necessary to rectify whatever is wrong and to shore up the foundations, to make our walls strong, to make our roof strong, to make our spirit strong, to make God the ruler of our homes, to make Christ the spirit of it, the foundation of it, to make love its what it feeds upon. Let's do whatever is necessary to make our homes this way. The world is looking for some leadership. Let's give it to them. We're going to sing this song of invitation as an encouragement. The subject being directed to the home, we urge those who are parents or those who are prospective husbands and wives, please consider the things that have been said today in the light in which they were given. And let's do what's right in the sight of God. And let's encourage each other as we stand and sing.